Well, this morning I'm going to be talking to you about some things that are good and fun and easy to talk about, some things that aren't so good, aren't so fun, aren't so easy to talk about, and I wish I could just talk to you about the positive things in my life. So much nicer to be able to do that, but that's not reality, and I want to really talk about reality today, so that involves some of the good and some of the bad. But the first thing that I want to talk to you about this morning is five things that I feel that I did right over the last 18 years being involved in ministry here at Willow Creek. So I'm going to start with the easy things, and then we'll move on to more difficult things. So five things that I feel that I've done right during my years in ministry. The first thing that I did right is that I really did try to maintain an authentic and a sincere relationship with the Lord. It didn't take me long in ministry to realize that I was way over my head in this ministry, and that if I wanted to survive, I would have to really learn how to tap into God's power. So I'm not standing up here saying that I had any noble motivation for being a spiritual woman. I just realized that I needed to be more than I could be in mere human strength if I wanted to survive the ministry. And so I'm glad that over the years God has forced me to kind of climb out on a limb where I could not afford to be phony. I could not afford just to do it on my own strength because I surely would have failed. So I think that was a good thing for me, a good motivation. But Isaiah 29:13 says, "These people come near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." I really did not want that to happen to me. I didn't want somebody to be able to say about me in the future, well, she spoke a good game, but she didn't really live it, or she didn't manifest that really from her heart. I didn't want that to happen to me. So I really tried to be disciplined and consistent in connecting with God and really growing in my personal walk with the Lord. And I certainly have not been as faithful to God as I wish I had been, but to the extent that I have been faithful to Him, He has certainly been faithful to me. And I say it honestly, I would not have survived the ministry without being able to tap into the real, vital, daily power of God. A prime example of that was last week when Bill and I did this message together. Several days before that, I had just an absolute panic attack. I thought, oh no, I cannot do this, but my name is in the program. It's too late to get out gracefully unless I have a car accident or something, you know, that would get me out of it. And so I went over to the local forest preserve where I go when I get really low. I mean, if people see me walking over there, they know I've hit bottom, you know. So I was over at the forest preserve just pouring out my heart to the Lord saying, I am terrified. I don't know what to say. And once I figure out what to say, I don't know if I'll be able to say it. And I can't do this. And I just felt this, you know, calming presence, like these hands on my shoulders saying, hey, calm down, it's okay. I am going to help you. I am going to give you knowledge. I'm going to give you the words that you need to say. And so many times over the years of ministry, I have had that experience where I thought, I cannot do it. This is beyond me. And yet when I take it to God in prayer, I really sense His strength and His power and His courage. I sense Him giving me words, and it really makes a difference. So that is one thing that I have done right over these last few years. The second thing that I did right in ministry is that I really, really loved this ministry. I felt when we started this church that God called me to start this church every bit as much as He called Bill. Now, He didn't call me to do the same things or to put in as much time or to be as visible as Bill has been, but He gave me the same passion for reaching the unchurched and the same frustration, really, with the church's experiences that I had grown up with. And so I shared that vision that He had. Now, sometimes it was very easy to love this ministry. Back in the very beginning, I had the opportunity to play in the band. I played the flute. And so every weekend I was up there with a band, and that was fun to come over and rehearse. You know, I grew up playing the flute in, you know, concert orchestras in long black skirts and white blouses. And here we were up on stage in red outfits and wearing, playing rock music. And it was just this whole entirely different feel, and it was so much fun. I loved being a part of that team. Later, I got involved with the Young Moms Ministry and helped start that ministry here, and then pass it off to somebody who could do a better job than I could as soon as I could do that. But it was fun being involved in that and seeing young moms come together and get encouraged. I've been involved in doing some teaching here and some writing for the magazine and different journals and publications we have here at the church, and that has been fun, again, to be a part of the team of ministry here. But at the same time, there have been many times when it was not very easy to love this ministry. The church has demanded a lot from Bill, and so it's demanded a lot of my time in kind of propping him up, keeping him going behind the scenes. And a lot of times I was very busy, but nobody saw it. Nobody applauded. Nobody said thank you. Nobody patted me on the back. And Bill was getting all these pats on the back. and I wasn't. And at those times, that was very hard to love the ministry then. And I have to say that I have struggled with that, and I'm sure that many of you have too. But at the same time, beneath that struggle, I was always driven and motivated by that real passion, the love for the ministry, the love and the desire to reach the non-church people in this community. And so as I look back, I can say that I'm very glad that I was in a position to be able to support Bill so that he could use his gift. And when I see what this church is doing now in the community and so on, there's nobody who's happier about that than I am, because I had the passion for this when it was just a little seed of an idea. And so it's been exciting to be a part of it these years. The third thing that I did right was that I was willing to move out of my comfort zone. For God's sake, I was willing to stretch and try new things, even though they were scary sometimes. When we started the church, I said to Bill, I will do anything to help you in this ministry. I will scrub toilets, I will wash floors, I will work in the nursery, you name it, I will do it. Except for one thing, don't ever ask me to speak. Don't ever put me up in front of people. That is not in my bag of tricks. I do not do that. That's just out of bounds, so don't even try. Well, he was smart enough to understand what I was saying, and so he did not ask me to speak. But at a certain point, I sensed that God was kind of giving me this nudge to do that, and I could say no to Bill, but I could not say no to God. At least it was hard to say no to him. And so I faced that challenge that God brought along my way. But that is not the only challenge that I faced in ministry. I'm basically a small-town Michigan girl, grew up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I grew up in a very safe, sheltered, unrushed environment. I dreamed of leading a quiet, slow-paced, low-stress, private life. I don't know why I married Bill Hybels. I should have seen this coming. I don't know why I didn't see it. But life with him has been the exact opposite of everything that I just mentioned. And it's been a constant challenge for me. And often I have faced the challenges of life kicking and screaming, saying, God, I can't do this. I can't do this. I wasn't cut out for this. And yet, as I look back, I am really glad that I did have the challenges that I have faced. And I'm glad that I moved out of that safe, narrow little world of mine that was so comfortable, because I have learned a couple lessons through that. First, I've learned that God really can be trusted to provide us strength for whatever he calls us to do. God is not in the business of pulling us out onto a limb and then just letting us hang there by ourselves until we fall. He really gives us the strength that we need. Now, sometimes we move out on a limb that's not according to his leading, and then we can't wonder where he is, you know, because he didn't lead us there. But when God calls us to do something, he will give us the strength that we need to do it. Also, I have learned that I am far more capable than I thought I was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, if somebody said, well, you will do this and this and this, I would say, no way. I mean, that is just not who I am. I could never do that, even if I wanted to do it, and I don't want to do it. And yet, God knew that there was potential in me that I didn't know I had, and he knew that there were desires deep inside me that I hadn't even acknowledged. And so had I stayed in my safe little world, I would have missed all of that, and I would have missed the great adventure that this church has been for us. So it was right for me to move out of my comfort zone. The fourth thing I did right was that I made marriage a priority. I made marriage a priority. When I look at the stress and the pace and the visibility in our life today, I realize that it is no small feat that our marriage has survived. And then when I look at the inside pressures on our marriage associated with our different temperaments, which are very different, our different family upbringings, the different expectations that we brought to marriage, I realize that it is an outright miracle that we have survived this institution called marriage. There have been so many times when both of us thought, it is just not worth it. It takes so much work to keep this thing together, and it's not worth it, and I just wish I could get out. But even at those times, we always made that conscious choice just to stick with it. We'd say, well, maybe if I work one more day, it'll get better. Maybe if I read one more book or listen to one more tape or go to one more seminar. And so we would do that. And every time then we would make a little bit of progress, then that would motivate us for the next time that we hit this valley. We'd say, well, I made it through one of these. I can make it through another one. And so we would just keep making little bits of progress. But often during the years that we've been in ministry, we've had to make some very difficult personal choices for the sake of our marriage. There was a time when Bill had to make some very radical schedule changes. He will talk more about that tonight, I think, to you. But there was a time when he went in and talked to the elders of our church, always the group, and said, you know, I cannot wear all the hats I've been wearing. I can't cover all the bases I've been covering. I'm destroying my wife and my family, and I cannot do this anymore. And if you need a pastor who can do all of this, then you'll have to get somebody else. And they were very responsive and very supportive and said, hey, you make the changes that you have to make. But that was a very difficult thing for him to do, and he had to make some radical changes. And when you're moving ahead in something and it's succeeding and everything is going well and everybody says this is great, it's pretty hard to move back and say, I'm sorry, I can't do all this anymore. And so that takes a lot of courage, a lot of discipline, and a real commitment to priorities. And yet he did that. There were also many times when I had to walk away from certain ministry opportunities just because I knew they wouldn't be good for our marriage. Maybe I really wanted to do it, but I knew it would take up too much time, too much energy, and I just knew that our marriage, you know, took a lot of work at that point, and so I couldn't do that. Also, we made it a point to establish a weekly date night, which eventually evolved into a date morning for us, just because we're morning people, and we just have a better time when we do it that way. But I've heard so many people say, oh, we just can't do that. We don't have the time to do it. Well, you do have the time to do it. Now, maybe something else has to go. It may have to be something very good, but there's certainly not anything more important than you could do at that one segment, that one time of your week, than to go out together and just have a good time. So we made it a point to do that. We knew that once a week there would be a time when we could have fun, when we could talk over things, when we could talk about the kids, when we could get into, you know, difficult conversations if that's what we needed. But we knew that we only had to store things up 7 days and that there was going to be a time for us to get together. We have also made it a point to plan periodic getaways, little mini vacations or longer vacations. And early in our ministry, I often felt guilty about taking vacations. I look at other people and I think, oh, well, these people aren't doing that and those people aren't doing that. But then when I saw all these ministry marriages go down, I thought, I wonder if that would have happened to them, if they had taken the time to get away from ministry, to just be together, to play, to pretend like they were dating again, to just be, you know, Bill and Lynn instead of Mr. and Mrs. or Mom and Dad or whatever. And so we really began to do that more consistently. And also when we travel apart, now we really make it a point to keep in very close contact over the telephone. I have to say that the more Bill travels, the higher our phone bills get. I mean, we really have a ridiculously high phone bill, but I think it's a worthwhile investment in keeping us in contact, enhancing our marriage. I think anything that any of us can do that can make our marriage stronger is well worth whatever it takes us to do that. We realize that it would have been very easy for us to become another sad statistic, another marriage gone wrong, and there have been so many of them in our society at large and in the ministry, so many. And yet we chose to make marriage a priority and reflected that in our choices that we made, in our schedules, in our conversations, and just our commitment to working through issues and just, you know, not glossing things over, but really trying to solve problems. And I have to say that we have had a very difficult marriage. If you attended that church, you would know that. We've been very open about that. The greatest challenge that either of us has faced has been our marriage. It's been much harder to build a good marriage than to build this church, and that's not a rhetorical kind of statement. That is the honest truth. This has been the biggest challenge of our lives. but we realize that the strength of our marriage is one of the most important things that we can give this church, and certainly one of the most important things that we can give our children. We also realize that we will be held every bit as accountable to God for what we do with our marriage relationship as what we do with our ministry. In fact, even more so. We are more accountable for what we do with our spouses and our marriage than what we do with our ministry. So we have made it a priority and worked at it even when we didn't feel like working at it, and told ourselves, no, we can't give up, even though we felt like giving up sometimes. And I would recommend to you our book, Fit to Be Tied, not because it's a wonderful book, but because it's a very honest book about the struggles of marriage that a lot of people face but few people want to admit. And we think it's very helpful to admit it and work on it and interact with other people and get help if you need it. The fifth thing that I did right in ministry was that I made my children a priority. Shauna, our almost 16-year-old, was born a year after we started Willow Creek, and Todd was born 3 years later. So almost from the beginning, I have been juggling ministry and child rearing. And to me, that was a very scary thing because I had seen so many ministers' kids grow up resenting the church, hating God, turning away from all of that, blaming God for taking their parents away from them. And I was determined that that would not happen to my kids. I said, I do not ever want my ministry involvement to be a hindrance to my kids. If that ever happens, I will look back with great regret, and I don't want to have to face that kind of regret. And, of course, Bill shared that commitment. So early on, we made a very difficult but conscious decision that we would disappoint other people before we would disappoint our kids. And we have done that. And that's not easy, especially when you're a people pleaser like I am. I don't like to disappoint anybody. But when a choice comes up, I'll disappoint other people before I'll disappoint my kids. We believe that God will not hold us responsible for meeting the needs of every person that comes along our path and meeting all the demands out there, but he will hold us responsible for how we have discipled and nurtured our children. We will stand before him and have to give an account of that, and we want to be able to do that with confidence. Now, sometimes it has not been at all easy for me to make my children a priority. There are many times when I would rather have been at church than at home. Many times when I would rather have been ministering, you know, out there somewhere where there's a little more fun and a little more attention and all of that than, you know, ministering through mothering. That is not the easiest way to minister. I mean, that's very demanding and you don't get many pats on the back for it. And there are many times when I would rather have been writing articles or something than changing diapers or driving another carpool. And I'm still driving carpools. We're on the verge of getting a license. My daughter is on the verge, and I can't wait. But and when she does, I'm going to assign her all my son's carpools. That's going to be her punishment for all these years. But it was especially hard for me when I saw many of my friends who didn't have children, and they were making such a mark in the ministry. They were so involved here, and they were receiving affirmation, and they were just so impressive. And I thought that would feel so good to be doing something like that and to get that kind of a pat on the back, and I wish I could have that right now. But you know, now that my kids are, you know, on the verge now of 16 and 13, almost two teenagers in the house now, I feel like I'm really beginning to get the reward. My daughter and I go out to breakfast on a regular basis. She has to be at school at 7:30, so we leave the house at 6:30, get to the restaurant at 6:45, leave the restaurant at 7:15, and dash off to school. So it's a quick little time together, but when you're 16, I mean, that's about all your mother can hope to get, believe me. If you can get that much a week, you're doing pretty good. But we go out for breakfast, and we talk about what's going on at school and pom-poms and what's happening in the youth group here at church and who she likes and who she doesn't like and all of that. And I sit there and I think, you know, we're starting to be friends. You know, it's moving into that stage where you really have a connection. You can have adult conversations. And I thought, this is the reward. This is when it really starts to pay off, all of that interest that you put in all those years. It starts to pay off as they get older, and it really is worth it, and I feel like I'm reaping the rewards. And I have been far from a perfect mom, especially with my daughter. She's very different from me, and I had a very hard time realizing that she was going to be, that she was going to go off in this direction while I went off in this direction. That was very hard for me to accept. But, you know, kids don't really need perfect moms. They just need moms and dads that are willing and committed enough to make hard decisions on their behalf and just really be there for them. And so I'm glad that I made that choice, and I'm enjoying reaping some of the benefits of that right now. So those are the five things that I did right. And see, it didn't take very long to talk about the things I did right. Things I did wrong are a little bit harder to talk about and take a little bit longer time. But while I was doing these five things right, I was also doing five things wrong, but I didn't realize it. I didn't realize it until about 15 years into the ministry that I was making some big mistakes. But at that point, the cumulative toll of these unwise choices began to catch up with me. And one particularly miserable, sleepless night, I got up in the middle of the night, went up to my little office, and poured out my heart to my computer. You know, when I have really awful things to say, I just go up and talk to my computer, never talks back, never misbehaves in any way. So I did that, but right now I want to read you just sort of an edited version of what I said that night to my computer, but ultimately to God, just to give you a little bit of an idea where I was and see if maybe some of you can relate to the situation. What more can I say to make you believe it? I can't go on like this. I can't live this life anymore. I keep rushing, rushing, rushing. I keep going, moving, doing, covering all the bases, responding to all the demands, the wishes, the suggestions, the oughts. I wish I could sleep for a week. I wish I could run away. But there are too many responsibilities. Bill is counting on me. I need to come through like I always do. But I am so tired. I feel so empty. It's like someone drained the life out of me. I feel like a robot, but not quite. I wish I were a robot. Then I could just program myself to do everything I'm supposed to do and not care and not desire and not feel and not hurt and not have a little core of individuality that yelps occasionally. I don't know how to please you, God. I want to be selfless. I want to be a difference maker. I want to sacrifice myself for something that really lasts, but I can't seem to do it. I end up sitting here longing, crying, wanting something for myself. I feel like such a failure. So often lately I've been on the verge of doing something stupid, of breaking something, throwing something, screaming, swearing, pounding my fists. I guess I'm angry, but at home. Maybe at myself. Maybe at my inability to cope. And I'm not coping. I'm not handling it anymore. I'm so tired of worrying about everybody else, of knowing everybody's needs, of seeing so much hurt and pain. I can't stand the seriousness of life anymore. Sometimes I wish I could go really crazy, babbling, sobbing, fetal position crazy. That's right, I don't want to come through this time. I don't want to squeak by again. I want to fall apart. I want to crash. I want the walls to crumble. Then somebody will have to see what's happening inside me, and things will have to change. But that will never happen, because I really don't want anybody to know. I don't want the desperation to show. So I'll paint over the scratches, I'll disguise the dents, I'll hide the cracks, and I'll come through. I'll be responsible. I'll get it all done. I'll cope. But as it turned out, that time I really couldn't cope. The emptiness led to exhaustion, which led to lingering depression, which ultimately led me to a Christian counselor's office. And that was something that I said would never happen to me. I thought I could always handle it on my own if I just try a little harder. And yet walking to that office was the smartest thing that I had ever done in my life. God used that very wise Christian healer to help me make sense of my pain and sense of my past. And so I want to talk right now about things that I've learned lately by pinpointing these five mistakes that I made. And you will notice that these mistakes I made are the flip sides of the very things that I did right. As I said before, the first thing that I did right was that I made a priority of my spiritual life. The problem was, I now realize, that I had a basic misunderstanding about what it meant to really relate to God. Now, in the past, if you had asked me if I felt secure in God's love, I would have said yes. I mean, my theology tells me that I can be secure in God's love, and sometimes I actually feel that. But the day-to-day reality was that I was really driven in my attempt to try to earn that love of God and to feel like I deserved it. So in spite of my theology, what I really believed is that I wasn't quite good enough, that I didn't quite measure up, that I had to do more, that I had to be stronger, that I had to be more productive, and so I was always pushing myself to please God. Now, I think one problem for me was that I had grown up in a church that placed a very strong emphasis on evangelism. And of course, I agree with that. We place a strong emphasis on that here, too. But in the church I grew up with, it was like one kind of evangelism that really mattered, and that was like hardcore street corner evangelism. You know, the person who could scoop up the most souls in the bucket was, you know, the best person in God's eyes. And maybe that's not what I was taught, but as a very sensitive child, that's what I perceived to be the message coming at me. And so I felt very guilty because I wasn't a good soul winner. I couldn't do that very well. And so it seemed that whatever my gift was, it wasn't the right one. And whatever I was trying to do, it wasn't the right thing to be doing. And so as I became an adult, in order to assuage that guilt, I just pushed myself harder and harder. I thought, well, if you just keep working in Christian service, you know, you won't have to worry about this evangelism piece out there that you don't know how to do. And so I kept pushing myself until eventually I just got to the point where I really couldn't push any longer. I just came to the end of my energy. The rug had been pulled out from under me, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And suddenly I wasn't strong, and I couldn't pretend that I was. I wasn't being productive, and I couldn't pretend that I was. I was exhausted, just thoroughly drained. And I remember so clearly during that period, I just had this overwhelming desire to sit in my living room and look out the window. And that was not at all like me. I was always very active, busy, constantly. And suddenly I just wanted to sit there. It's like I just did not have the energy to get up and do anything. And even when I tried to think of things that I used to enjoy doing, I didn't want to do them either. I just had no energy. I became very depressed and very confused, and I hated what had become of me. I thought, how did this happen? How did I get here? And I couldn't stand being like that, but I didn't know what to do about it. Well, at that point, I desperately needed God. I needed to tap into that strength that I was talking about a little while ago, but at that time, I just could not pray. I was afraid that if I turned to God, that He would turn back to me and say, come on, get up, pull yourself together, get with the program, get back to work. This is nonsense, you're being silly. Just get on with it. And I thought, you know, I love the Lord, I want to please him, but I cannot handle hearing that right now. I can't do it. And so, not out of rebellion or anything like that, but rather out of fear, I became very estranged from God. I just could not approach him because I was afraid of what I might hear. At a certain point, however, during this area, I felt one day this just strange compulsion that I had to tune into God. Uh-oh, the time has come, I have to pray. It's like somebody had their hands on my shoulders, you know, pushing me up the stairs, and I'm holding back, and they're making me go upstairs to my little office and pray. So I went up there kind of with fear and trembling. I said, okay, God, I'm here, I'm listening. I don't want to be, but I'm here and I'm listening. And I seemed to sense God saying to me, now what if Todd, who is, he's our 12-year-old, who is very sensitive, very gentle child, he's the kind of kid that you would just never want to do anything to hurt. He's really a sweet little guy. God seemed to say to me, now if Todd came to you, and if Todd was exhausted and confused and drained and needy and just feeling really low, what would you do? How would you react to him? How would you treat him? I'm like, oh God, you know what I'd do. I'd scoop him up in my arms, I'd hug him, I'd try to lift his burden, I'd talk to him, I'd encourage him. I would do anything to just to ease the load he was carrying and just tell him to relax and recuperate and everything's going to be okay. And I wouldn't put any expectations on him. I'd just say, just get better, Todd. Take care of yourself. God said, well, that's what I have been trying to do for you, and you just won't let me. You are so determined to see me as your commanding officer who's heaping more burdens and more tasks on your head that you won't let me treat you like the fragile little child that you are. You won't let me do that for you. And that was a very powerful experience for me because it seemed to me that God had come to me. I mean, I didn't go to him. I was trying to avoid him. But he came to me and expressed his love in a very real pictorial way that I could grasp. I mean, you're talking about loving me like I love Todd. Well, I understand that. That got through to me. And God used that means to communicate his love to me at the time when I was at the bottom. I mean, I wasn't doing anything good to deserve that. I wasn't serving him. I wasn't being impressive. I wasn't even praying. I mean, I was running away from him, and he came to me and expressed his love for me. And that just made a tremendous difference to me. And God said, look, I'm going to put you back together, and I'm going to show you that my ministry can go on without your heroic efforts. You don't have to be all these things for me. I can do it without you. You just be who I want you to be. And who I want you to be right now is a fragile child who has to recover. Well, when I was at the bottom, at that point I became familiar with this terminology of the fragile child, and I thought, well, okay, I'm a fragile child, but I'll get over this real fast, and I'll be right back on top. Well, time has gone on, and it seems like I'm still a fragile child. I guess I always was, and I just didn't want to admit it. And maybe not all of us are fragile children, but I think that many of us are. Underneath all of that armor and all of that energy and all of that productivity, we are fragile children who need to be loved and nurtured by a very kind Heavenly Father. So I guess I'm still a fragile child, and if that's okay with God, then I have to say it's okay with me. So I don't push myself so hard anymore. I don't try to carry all these burdens. I don't try to be heroic. I admit my limits, and I'm doing a much better job at living within them. And I'm scheduling more downtime for myself because I know that's what I need. Maybe some people don't need that, but I do, and it seems to be okay with God, so I'm going to do it. And when people come to me and tell me how busy they are and how much pressure they're under and how much they're accomplishing and how hard they're pushing and they just kind of seem really revved up by it, I say, well, that's fine. If you can do that, that's wonderful. But I can't. I'm one of God's children, one of God's fragile children, and I'm not going to try to keep up with the rest of you anymore. And if he accepts that, then I need to too. And this whole experience, it was a very humbling experience. I mean, whenever you come face to face with your limits and realize that you have to accept them, that's humbling and that's very hard to take. But this also had a very tremendous effect on my spiritual life and my relationship with the Lord. I always wanted to really adore God. I wanted to be like Mary in the Bible, who sat at Jesus' feet, and I could just always envision the adoring look on her face, the rapt attention as she listened to Jesus, and how you could just tell that she really loved this person. She appreciated him and just really loved him with her emotions. And I wanted to feel that way, but I didn't. And that was very frustrating to me. And so I kind of try to work up that kind of feeling and pray for it. But more often than not, I would just end up going to God and saying, you know, I really want to love you, but I don't love you as much as I want to. And just forgive me for not loving you as much as I should and just accept this little feeble offering of love that I give you. But it was a very frustrating aspect of my spiritual life. I now realize that you cannot really feel love for someone who you perceive is heaping burdens on you. You can't love someone who you feel is forcing you to race through life at such a pace that it makes you miserable. You can respect that person, you can fear that person, you can honor that person, but you cannot really love that person. Not the way I think we all want to, you know, in our real quiet moments when we'd like to have that adoring relationship with the Lord. That can't happen if our Lord is someone who's making our lives miserable. Now that I have dropped some of the burdens, and I am beginning more to perceive God as this loving Father who cares for this fragile child, I am finding myself adoring God. And I don't have to try to work up this feeling. I don't have to apologize for not having it. I feel that because of the freedom that God has given me to be who I am. And another day when I was over at the Forest Preserve, I was just walking around thinking about different things that I had been learning, and I just found myself suddenly saying, God, I just love you for all the things I don't have to be for you anymore. You know, before it was like, oh, Christianity is such a burden. We've got to have to be so many things. And now it's like, geez, I have all these things I don't have to be. I just have to be this one little person that God created me to be and nothing more than that. And a God that gives me that freedom to just be me, I can really love and adore that God, and I do. And so this has been a tremendous lesson to learn. I think it's something that you can only learn when you kind of reach the pit, when you're at the bottom. As long as you're coping and keeping everything together and handling it, or at least pretending that you are, I don't think you can learn that lesson. I think you have to really come face to face with your inadequacy, your hurt, your pain, your weakness, and let God touch that part of you. And then you can learn this lesson. And so, very glad I did. I wish I had learned it many years ago. Now, the second thing that I said I did right is that I loved the ministry. The problem was that sometimes I loved the ministry too much and myself too little. For years, I believed that I had a twofold goal in life. The first goal was to do whatever I could do to enhance the ministry. And the second goal was to never do anything that would hinder the ministry. Now, translated into everyday terms, that meant that the ministry was all important and I basically was unimportant. And so I got much better at taking care of the ministry and other people than taking care of myself. I really thought that it was right and fitting that I should submerge my needs and my desires for the sake of ministry. Did I wish that Bill could be home more? Did I wish we could have a real marriage like I saw some other people having? Well, too bad. The ministry needed him more than I did, apparently, and I had to accept that. Did I wish that we could live at a slower pace, that we could reduce the pressure in our lives? Well, too bad. The ministry had to move ahead faster and faster all the time, and if that caused pressure and stress on us, well, that was just too bad. Was I tired of handling all the home and family responsibilities so that Bill could be out ministering? Was I tired of being so consumed by Bill's life and gifts and by other people's demands that I had no time to use my own gifts and no energy to live my own life? Well, that too was too bad. That's just what it takes to build a church, and I had to accept that. So whenever there was a conflict between what seemed to be best for the ministry and what seemed to be best for me, the ministry won. And I thought that that was the right and noble thing for me to do, and that it was a God-honoring choice that I was making. Eventually, however, that choice or a series of choices like that eventually caught up with me in a big way, and with a lot of anger and bitterness and resentment, I realized that I had given up way too much for the sake of the ministry and that I had really hurt myself by denying my own feelings and my own needs. And I realize now that it was not right for me to do that, and it was also not right for Bill that I did that. See, all these years I thought, aren't I wonderful? I'm so good, such a wonderful pastor's wife, sacrificing myself for the church like this. And yet my self-sacrificing choices hurt Bill by enabling him to live a very imbalanced, unhealthy life for a long time. I mean, I was so responsible about picking up the pieces of his life and covering for him, keeping things going for him, that he could just keep running and running and running until he eventually crashed. And again, he will talk more about that tonight. but my choices end up hurting me by causing me to become a very bitter, angry, unhappy woman with a lot of unfinished business that I had to end up dealing with. And in the end, it hurt Bill. So this seemingly noble, self-sacrificing choice that I made really ended up helping no one in the end. And I think it created an unhealthy model for other people in our church. So I regret that very much. And I do talk more about that on the tape from Sunday, so I would recommend that you listen to that if you're interested in that type of thing. The third thing, again, that I did right was that I was willing to move out of my comfort zone. The problem was that I moved way too far out of my comfort zone. Again, I'm glad that I moved out, that I stretched, and that I grew, but I just went too far. I went so far that I began to believe that I was only pleasing God when what I was doing was so hard that it just took absolutely everything that I had, and it made me miserable. I mean, if it made me miserable, it had to be right. Now, I know that sounds strange when you lay it out that way, real concise, but in reality, don't we begin to think that sometimes? At least I did. I really think I was convinced of that. And I learned that when you operate under that kind of belief system, you are headed for trouble. Just undoubtedly, you will end up in trouble. I got to the point where nearly everything I did was out of line with how my temperament and gifts and passions are. It was uncomfortable for me. It was just a major stretch. Like, every day was like that. When I finally pulled back from that, I realized that I had had a stomach ache for ages. You know, nothing serious, but just those little nervous butterflies that had become so routine that I hardly even knew they were there. And once I pulled back, I thought, wait a minute, I don't have a stomach ache. And I did for a long time. So that's how out of line I was living. Now, I just want to give you a few illustrations of how this can happen and how it happened with me. First, I am by temperament an introvert. I can fool people sometimes, but the truth is I need a lot of time alone. I prefer having just a few relationships, and that people interaction really does drain me. Tomorrow, or even tonight, when I'm at home, I will feel like, oh, I need this time alone, a day of interaction. And speaking, public speaking, I don't do very much, but when I do it, it's very draining because there's a kind of people interaction that goes along with it that drains me, and that's just part of my introverted self. But the thing is, I didn't understand about introverts and extroverts. I didn't understand this about me, and so for years, I lived a totally extroverted life. I was with people all the time, and then I wondered why I always felt drained and empty and unhappy. I had fantasies about jumping up on the information booth in the main lobby and saying, "Would everybody just please leave me alone? Get out of here." They probably would have left me alone, put me in a straitjacket or something. But, I just felt like at the point where I hated people. And now I realized that I really had not lost my compassion for people, but I was trying to live like an extrovert, and it was destroying me. Fortunately, I came across a book, which I can't read. It's down there called Please Understand Me. It talks about the Myers-Briggs type indicator, talks all about introverts and extroverts. Thank you. And many different things, and if you want to come up here and get this information later from this book cover, you can. But I think this book saved me. I was headed for ruin. I was going to self-destruct because I was pushing myself with people too much, and I needed to back down. I've realized now that I have to watch the balance in my life very carefully. Now, last weekend, doing the message with Bill, we had four services and then lines of people afterwards, and by Sunday night, I was really drained, and I thought, oh my goodness, it's Sunday night and Friday I have to go to the conference and I have to give another workshop. Now, I have to be very careful. I had to be careful how I lived from Sunday night until this morning because I knew I had to energize. And so I had to make it a point not to plan a real busy week with people because I thought I need to recoup this week because I have to make another output on Friday. So in the past, I didn't know anything about that. I would come over to these conferences and stay the whole time and talk with everybody and then go home and just kick the dog and yell at my kids and say, leave me alone, and rip the phone off the wall, and thought, why am I doing this, And I finally realized that I just have to be much more careful than that. Now, some of you don't have to do that at all, and I envy you, you wonderful extroverts who can handle all that. But some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, and you have wondered for ages what was wrong with you, right? What is wrong with me? I'm not like everybody else. Well, I'm not like everybody else. God makes us all different. But now I realize that God does make extroverts, and he also makes introverts, and if we have to be whatever we are and live according to that, so this made a tremendous difference. Another example is that I like kind of a slow-paced life, kind of quiet, ordered, manageable. I don't like a lot of chaos. When I rush, I am not effective I'm not productive, I'm not creative, in a rush. And yet I realized that for 17 years I lived in a constant rush. Much of that time I had a rather serious sleep problem. I realize now it was because every night I went to bed thinking, how am I going to make it through tomorrow? How am I going to squeeze it all in? How am I going to do that? And then when I finally would get to sleep, it'd be about time to wake up, and I'd get up in the morning and think, oh no, it's here, and I got to start running, and I'm not ready. And it was a terrible situation, but I just thought it was my problem. I thought there was something wrong with me because Bill can rush. He's just that kind of person. He's very effective in the midst of tension. I mean, he gets a thrill. You know, the more that's going on, the more challenges, the more balls that are bouncing around, the better he likes it. And so I thought I should be like that, and I thought I had to keep up with him. But the thing is, he can live constructively in that situation, and I can't. And so he was succeeding, and I was failing, and it was terrible. And I've just realized now that I have to slow down and say, if he wants to go that fast, he can, but I'm not going to try to do it anymore. Another example is that I really enjoy writing. Not necessarily because I have a lot to say, but I like the writing lifestyle. I like the solitude. I like the kind of thinking processes that are involved with putting material together for print. I like playing around with words. However, I always thought it was much more spiritual, of course, to be with people, to be ministering directly to people. So I ended up kind of getting on a speaking circuit locally, going around to different churches and speaking at retreats and luncheons and so on. And I really hated it. I mean, I hated it so much that I thought, it must be from God. It made me so miserable. This must be His will. So I kept doing it for quite a while, but eventually I got to the point of desperation, and I thought, you know, rebel or what? I mean, maybe this is horrible and radical and terrible, but I've just got to admit that I hate doing this, and I'm just going to quit. And terrible person that I am, I'm going to stay home and write instead. Well, obviously that was the best choice that I could have made. God created me for some reason to sit around in little dark closets and play around on word processor, and I hate to describe what I do that way, but that's what it is. But He made me that way, and I have found that I can really minister to God, minister for God, and minister to people much more effectively by spending more of my time doing that and less of my time doing speaking, and I'm much happier that way. But I really believe that Christian leaders need to learn that it is very, very draining to live contrary to who God made you to be. When you do that, you end up working very hard, accomplishing very little, and being very frustrated. I mean, it's a lose-lose situation all the way around. But when you learn to be true to who God made you, when you are working and serving according to your temperament and your gifts and your passion, then you can work less, accomplish more, and have a great time while you're doing it. But really, I think few people catch on to that. So we all go around working so hard, doing the wrong things, and not enjoying it. So I just wish that I had learned that lesson again a long time ago. I could have saved myself a lot of grief and frustration. So the fourth thing that I did right was that I made marriage a priority. The problem was that sometimes I made it work at my expense. Because of the position that we were in, I was convinced that we had to have a good marriage. We had to have peace in our home. I kept thinking, oh, Bill has got to get up there and speak, and it's so hard to do that when there's tension in your home. So, you know, I don't want him to have to fake that. So I got to make sure that we're, you know, have peace in our home. And people are looking at us, and so we have to be a model for them. So I had this great sense of urgency to have a peaceful marriage, to have a happy marriage, to do it all right. But I realize now that sometimes the easiest for me to achieve that state in our marriage was just to kind of sweep the real issue under the rug and give in. And Bill did that sometimes too, but I think I was a better giver-inner than he was. So sometimes we didn't do that. Sometimes we did deal with the real issues and establish a legitimate peace, but too often I think I just gave in for the sake of peace. I am by nature a peace-loving person. I can't stand disharmony, so I would, you know, tend to give in for that reason. Also, Bill is just a much more dominant personality, and I had a very hard time standing up to him. We talk about that a lot in our message on Sunday, so if you can relate to that at all, you might be interested in that. Also, I knew Bill was under so much stress, and I didn't want to add another burden to him by saying, hey, you know, I'm really not happy about this, so I would just kind of give in. But we did this in many areas of our life where I would just sort of submerge my preferences and go along with his. We did it relationally. You know, he's a much more extroverted person, so he would want to be with people all the time, and I wouldn't, but I just kind of go along with him. We did it in terms of how we use our recreational time, how we scheduled our travel time and many things like that. We also did it in regard to our personal passion for ministry. Bill is, by gift, an evangelist, and in his personal ministry, his individual ministry, he really likes to make use of that gift, and he has a really incredible ability to reach out and minister to the rich young rulers of the world, the people who have power and success and don't need anybody, including God. He really has an ability to kind of break through their defenses, get to the real person, and show them that they do in fact need God. And it's really remarkable to watch him in action doing this. He can ask people questions and probe in ways that I've just never heard anybody do. And so I really enjoy watching him in action. And we have also often been involved in discipleship groups or ministry situations where he can use that kind of gift. Well, my passion, ever since I was a little girl, was more for the poor, for the downtrodden, for the obviously needy people of the world. I went to college to be a social worker. I mean, that was my whole orientation. I was not aiming for the rich young rulers of the world. Unfortunately, over the years, we got so busy pursuing Bill's passion and his giftedness that I really had no time to center in on that passion of mine. And that was frustrating because I missed that. Plus, I never really felt that comfortable in these situations that we would be in together discipling and whatever. And so I was frustrated by that. I was saddened by it, but I just thought that's the way it is. That's how it has to be. Then several years ago, I had a sense that, gee, maybe I shouldn't have allowed that passion to just fall by the wayside. And so an opportunity came along to go with a work team down to an orphanage in Mexico that our church helps to sponsor for a week in the Baja Peninsula, California. So I went down there for a week. My mother went with me, and with a group of actually the prime time age group here at church. It was mostly kind of college and young career age people, and then me and my mother. So we went down there for a week, and I just remember sitting in this absolute dust bowl of a place covered with grime and grit and passing out canned peaches to these little Oaxacan Indian kids. And I was sitting there thinking, this is me. I mean, this is where I belong. This is the kind of thing I was made for. And it was so exhilarating. I just loved being there. And I realized it had been so long since I had felt that kind of excitement and that kind of passion. And I realized that that is not right for us to let our personal passions die. God put them in us. And he didn't ask us to abandon them when we got married. And yet many of us do. And so Bill and I have made it a point to be much more balanced in our approach to the ministry opportunities that we get involved with. And I still support him in the kind of ministry opportunities that are really appropriate for him, but he's become much more conscious of supporting me in the things that I want to get involved in, whether that means making the finance available or childcare or just doing whatever he can to support me in this. We have learned that when one spouse sort of becomes a clone of the other spouse, then that spouse ends up having nothing fresh and dynamic and alive to bring to the marriage. That person becomes diminished as an individual, and then the marriage becomes diminished. A marriage means two people to be alive and full and vital and pursuing their passions and energized, and that's very important and yet very hard to hang on to in a ministry marriage. But I think that Bill would say that I contribute far more to our relationship now, that I'm much happier to live with, that I'm more pleasant, that I have more energy now that I am reestablishing my individuality and pursuing some of the God-given interests that I have. And so I think he would attest to the fact that this has been a healthy change for us to make. Now, the fifth thing that I did right, again, was I made my children a priority, but the problem was that I took on way too much of the parenting responsibility in our family. I look back and think now that I should have sought, begged, borrowed, requested, demanded, whatever, more involvement from Bill in the practical aspects of child rearing. Bill has always been great with the kids in terms of his relational, emotional involvement with him. They adore him. They feel very loved by him, and I'm very grateful for that. But in terms of the time-consuming, nitty-gritty daily tasks of raising children, he was really not involved in that at all. And because I knew he was under so much stress, I felt I should protect him and shield him, so I didn't feel that I had the right to ask him for help. But again, I think I just went too far in this regard, and I ended up sowing seeds of bitterness in my life and really creating a great deal of frustration on my part. People used to joke about Bill not knowing how to change a diaper or bathe a toddler, and you know, I'd laugh, I'd go along with it, but I really didn't think it was funny. I didn't think it was fair. I felt like a single parent, and I thought, this isn't right. I'm married. I'm pouring energy into this marriage and into this family. Why should I have to go through life feeling like a single parent? And so I really resented that. I realize now that I should have been more honest with him. I should have said, now and then I need a break, and now and then I need a little more involvement from you. I know that this would have forced change. It would have forced Bill to readjust his schedule a bit, but I look back now and I realize that that would have been better for him, would have been better for the kids, it would have been better for me, and I think it would have been better for the church. Again, I think we would have presented a much healthier model for the young couples growing up and marrying in our church. But again, it was my obsessive covering for him that allowed us to slip into a rather negative pattern. The good news under this point is that this can change, that it is possible to turn the train in the opposite directions, and we really have made some radical changes. This past fall, I went on a trip for almost 3 weeks, and Bill covered with me with the help of some kind friends and his mother, and let me see, I could go down the list of all his helpers, but he did cover for me, and it was very hard for me to ask him to do this. But when I did, he said, you know, you've done that for me for many years, and it's about time to turn the tables, and you deserve a break, so go ahead and do it. And when I came back, he said, well, where are you going next year? So I'm planning that trip. But I think it's very important for devoted moms to get a break now and then. It's important for dads to help them do that, for these women, these wives, for us to feel supported by our husbands in this. It's very important, and again, a long time ago, I should have expressed myself much more openly and honestly to Bill. Now, I do have to say this for the sake of all these men in here and for all the men who you will play this tape for, that one thing that I do love about the man that I'm married to is that when he senses that something is amiss, when something has been out of balance, when he's done something wrong, when he realizes it, he is willing to make changes. He will say, oops, I'm wrong. And even if it causes hardship for him or inconvenience or readjustment of his schedule, he is willing to do that. And I have learned that you can put up with a lot of pain and frustration in a relationship if you sense there is that attitude, that willingness to give and take, that willingness to say, hey, I'm wrong. Hey, we can go in a different direction. Just because we've done it this way for 10 years doesn't mean we have to keep on doing it that way. And when there is that kind of attitude and that flexibility, you can put up with a lot. And you can go through a lot and say, hey, I still love this person very much. So that is something I really appreciate about him. And I think all of these things, these five things that I've just talked about, could all fit under the umbrella heading of misunderstanding what it means to die to self. Misunderstanding what it means to die to self. The Bible does teach us to die to sinful desires and impure motives and lusts and envies and carnal preoccupations and any other sins and personal agendas that keep us from yielding to God's will. I mean, the Bible does call us to do that, all of us, and we must do that if we want to be obedient to the Lord. But I thought that dying to self meant that I had to deny my legitimate needs and my justifiable desires, and that I had to try to be somebody I wasn't, that I had to keep everybody else happy at my expense, and that in marriage and in other relationships, I had to give up my preferences for the sake of peace. That's what I thought dying to self meant. And 17 years of that kind of dying took its toll. And if I had to give this message a title, I'd call it, I Died to Self, and My Self Almost Died. Because that's exactly what happens, and I see it happening to many people in Christian leadership. It happens to many women and also many men in ministry. We get so good at taking care of other people that we forget to take care of ourselves. Plus, we know that everybody is watching us, and so we want to play it safe in how we dress or who we talk to or how we spend our time or our money or in our energy. We just are always so conscious of people watching us, and so we want to keep everybody happy, and we're trying so hard to do that, that pretty soon who we are, the essence of who we are, doesn't exist anymore. We're just sort of a mirror, a reflection of other people's wishes and expectations, and that little core of individuality that used to yelp a little bit doesn't yelp anymore at all because it's totally been killed off. And there's a sad phenomenon that Bill and I have often seen with busy corporate businessmen in this area, but we see it a lot with pastors and their wives, too. The husband is so busy and his life is so out of balance that he has to, by necessity, make incredible demands on his wife. His life is so out of control that he can't handle it on his own, so she has to help him. So she makes this choice, okay, I'll do it, it's necessary. So she gives up so much of herself in order to keep him going. And wonder of wonders, he does keep going. I mean, she helps him, and he succeeds, and he makes it, and he's happy. But he gets to this point where he's got it made, and she is absolutely drained, tired out, wasted, herself has died because she's poured it all into him. Well, one morning he wakes up and he looks at her and he says, hey, this isn't the fun, creative, lively, vibrant woman I married. What happened? And he doesn't even realize that it was the pace and the demand of his life that drained it out of her. And again, that happens a lot, happens all too often. When that happens, when a woman kind of gets lost along the way, she ends up with very low self-esteem, because when there's nobody left inside anymore, there's nobody to love. And so you end up just really hating yourself. And I know that's true because that's what happened to me. And that's exactly how I felt. And that forced me to get to the point where I went to a counselor and I said, help me. I don't know what happened to me, but I have to find myself and I need some help. And so then I really had to begin a process of rebuilding. And we do talk more about that on the other tape again, so I'd recommend that. But part of rebuilding for me was learning to talk more honestly and openly to Bill about my needs and my desires, my preferences, and just not be afraid to come right out and say, hey, I need this from you, or I need the freedom to do this, or whatever. It also involved learning to live more comfortably and not always push so far out of my comfort zone. I still believe that, you know, sometimes God calls us to do very hard things. And sometimes he calls us to do things that we said we would never do, and he will give us the strength to do that. But if we live every day of our lives just on this edge of discomfort with this tension constantly, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's what God has called us to do. And so I'm learning to live a little bit more comfortably. I'm being truer to the temperament and the gifts and the passions that he has given to me. Now, one major part of my rebuilding process was this trip that I took last fall, which I mentioned earlier. I did this last September, the end of September. I drove alone from Chicago to a guest ranch in Montana so I could go horseback riding and hiking in the mountains. And it was great fun. It was a wonderful trip. And it was very significant to me for a number of reasons. Now, when I planned this trip, I didn't want to tell anybody about it. I just had this thing. I kept thinking, why is this this big secret? And I finally realized that so much of my life was public. Like, everybody knew everything. And I just wanted to do something that nobody knew about. You know, I didn't want to have to check with them and, you know, make sure everybody knew what was going on. I just wanted to do it. And I thought, gee, I must really have a need for privacy if I'm planning this trip this way. If I did tell somebody I was doing this, I said, well, I'm turning 40. And I always said when I turn 40, I want to do something fun. You know, I don't want to do an over-the-hill party. I want to do something that makes me feel young and fun. And so this is what I'm doing. And that was partly the truth. But I also sensed that I had to take this journey. And it was not just an external journey, but I had to take an internal journey. And somehow it was tied up with this whole external trip. And as it turned out, it really was a journey of two kinds for me. And God really did have some very important lessons to teach me on that trip. The second day that I was out, after I left Chicago and drove through Illinois and Iowa and then up into South Dakota. And on the second day, I stopped in the Badlands of South Dakota. I don't know how many of you have ever been there, but it's a very spectacular formation of mountains and meadows and everything. It's a very barren area, but very beautiful, just a really unusual place on earth. And it was a very holy, sacred place for the Indians. And when I was there that day, it became a very holy and sacred place for me, too. I went hiking by myself. Again, there in September, there are not many tourists out, and so I kind of had the place to myself. Went hiking through these mountains, crawling and climbing over things, and then I sat on this little grassy knoll, and I just thought, you know, it's just me and the universe here, me and God here, and I am here because I want to be here. I love nature, and I love being alone and put it all together, and here it is. I love this. I thought, I'm not here because somebody told me I had to be here, because somebody expected me to show up here. I'm not here because Bill had to be here and I had to tag along behind him. I am here because I want to be here. And it just felt so good. It felt like a whole new experience. And I thought, this shouldn't feel like a whole new experience. I ought to have a lot of things in my life that I do because I want to do them. And I realized then that I didn't. I really did not have many want-tos in my life. And I learned right then that I need to have a lot more Badlands experiences that really refresh me and energize me and let me say, this is me. This is the kind of thing God made me for, and he put these desires and interests in my life. Now, if you've never been where I've been, you don't understand what I'm saying at all. You don't see the significance of this. But if you have felt this way, and if right now your heart is beating, you're thinking, oh, I want to do something like that, then I really encourage you to do it. Experiment and find a way to do something that makes you feel like, this is me. This feels great, it's exhilarating, and it's what I was made for. And if you think, oh yeah, I'd like to do that, but I don't have the faintest idea what I would do, well, I'm not surprised, because many women get to a certain point in their life and they say, it's been so long since I've done anything just for me or anything for enjoyment that I don't even know what I would enjoy anymore. And so you kind of have to begin experimenting. And for me, I knew I wanted to take a trip, and I thought, well, where would I want to go? I don't know. The only thing that came to my mind is that I used to like to ride horses. I mean, way back sometime, long ago, I used to ride horses. So I shaped this whole trip around being able to go and ride some horses. And really, the horses were a small part of the trip. There was so much more than that. But one of the neatest things about that was that while I was out having all these, you know, wonderful experiences, I really sensed God's pleasure. I really sensed God saying, yes, yes, I want you to enjoy things like this. I made you for moments like this. Grab them. Do it. Enjoy things like this. And I really needed that affirmation, because, you know, there's a part of me that sort of felt guilty. I mean, we're supposed to be miserable, right? We're supposed to be rushing and all this. We're not supposed to enjoy life. Because, yes, you are supposed to enjoy life. And if you enjoy life, then you will be much more effective in your service for me when I call you to do that. So that was a big lesson to learn. Another reason why this trip was significant was that it was really the first time in 20 years that I have really and truly felt like I was out from under Bill Heibel's shadow. I met people who didn't know my last name, who didn't know my husband's position, who didn't know that I was a pastor's wife, just knew I was this crazy woman from Chicago driving across the country for no particular reason. But I met artists, I met potters, I met cowboys, I met all kinds of people, and I had wonderful conversations and just a lot of fun conversations. And so often I would think, you know, this person is just relating to me. I mean, they seem to be enjoying this conversation, and it's not because they know who my husband is. I mean, it's just me they're relating to. And that felt so good. In real life, I seldom have that sense that people look at me and just see me. I mean, there's all this other baggage attached to me. There's Bill, and there's the church, and there's the kids, and there's whatever other things that kind of, you know, take pieces of our identity. But on this trip, I was just me. And I related to people, and it felt good, and I just really recommend that. And I think it's very important for all wives to be acknowledged, all wives and all husbands, to be acknowledged for who they are. And if it's a part of your real life that doesn't happen very often, that's fine. I mean, I can live with this, but it's nice to be able to get out from under it now and then and have just a little taste of just being your own person for a while. And, you know, it's embarrassing to talk about this. Who talks about this? Everybody says, oh, I don't mind living in my husband's shadow. But it's hard, isn't it? I mean, maybe we don't mind it a lot, but it's still kind of hard, and I think that sometimes we need to get out from under it. So that was something that was fun for me. Now, there was a time when all of the things that I just said, I would have thought that those were very self-centered, selfish things, and the antithesis of what it means to really be a good Christian and really offer ourselves to God. But I realize now that we can only give ourselves to God if we have a self to give. I mean, if we get lost along the way, what do we have to offer Him? Only if we are strong in our individuality can we be strong as a servant of the Lord. Otherwise, all we will have to offer will be our emptiness, our weakness, and our sadness. It's also very true that we can only give ourselves in marriage if we have a self to give. You know, even if we give up ourselves for our husbands for the noblest of reasons, our husbands will be the losers in the end. A couple summers ago, Bill and I really began to get in touch with what was going on in our marriage and going on in me. And Bill said, you know, I think I understand what you're talking about. Sometimes I hug you, and I feel like I'm hugging air. It's like there's nobody home anymore. I said, voila, that's what I'm trying to tell you, and that's what happened. And you see, he was the loser, because I was no longer the person that he married and fell in love with, and that was disappointing to him. He needed me to be that person, and so I need to become that person again. Now, as I look back, I think that I could have stood up to the marketplace. If Bill had been in business, I think I could have said, for money, for ego, for power, for pleasure, I will not do this. I will not give this up for that kind of temporal value. But when it's ministry, you know, when it's people's lives, when it's God and it's eternity, you think, how can I say anything against this? How can I stand up and say, hey, I'm a person too? I mean, so what if I'm a person? There's this big thing, you know, that has to be done. And, you know, really there are no easy answers. We all live with that tension. That's reality. The ministry is very important, and we do want to enhance it and all of that. So I think it helps to bring out these bring these issues out into this into discussion. And I don't have any simple answers, but I think that it really helps to begin talking about it and dialoguing between husband and wife. Now, if you can relate to what I have said, and if you're at that point in your life when you are really kind of feeling empty inside, that you're just like a shell, I really encourage you to be very honest with the Lord and express your feelings. And if you feel like a fragile child, then tell him that. You will just be amazed at the response that you will get from him. It will just, it will blow your mind. It will just go beyond anything you could imagine. And when I hit bottom and was really forced to acknowledge that I was a fragile child, I realized that God had been waiting to be tender with me for a long time. But I had been too busy working and striving and trying to be something for him to let him touch me in that way. And I think it's very unfortunate, but many of us have a much easier time listening to the tough things that God says to us than the tender things. And I think a lot of us really need to hear the tender things. Secondly, I would really encourage you to be honest with your spouse. If you're like me, a lot of you have a lot of things stuffed inside, and it needs to come out into the open. And when it comes out into the open, it will cause chaos. It will be horrible. It will not be fun. It will be terrible. You'll think, oh, anything is better than this chaos. But really, it's the only way through and into a really healthy relationship. So learn to speak constructively and assertively and state your case in a logical way. And just begin a real open communication with your husband. And if you want to listen to this tape together, that might be a good way to start. I'd also encourage you to choose a close friend or a counselor, somebody that you can talk to. Many times over the years, I said to myself, oh, I should go to a counselor. But then I said, no, I can handle this if I just try a little harder or get another book or just work through this. I can do it. I can handle it on my own. But when I finally did get to the bottom and sought help, I realized that God had prepared a person to help me. I mean, you know, God was waiting in the wings to be tender to me, but he also had, you know, somebody with skin on waiting in the wings to be tender with me and to help me, and somebody that he had prepared just for me. I've said to her many times, you know, if you had nobody else coming to me, your life would be totally justified by the fact you're putting my life totally back together. She's really helped me, and I know that God just really prepared her for me. And I think that sometimes we don't stumble upon the means of healing that God has for us because we're not willing to say that we need it. We're not willing to get to that point where we say, well, okay, I guess I can't do it on my own anymore, so what do you have for me? So I really encourage you to get help. There are some other books that I would like to recommend to you. Codependent No More by Melody Beattie. A lot of you knew that's what I was talking about. Codependent No More. Also From Bondage to Bonding. That's a book on codependency from a very biblical perspective. A very good book by Nancy Groom. Also the book A Hunger for Healing by Keith Miller, which is, again, a biblical approach to the 12-step program. And it's truly, it's by my nightstand. It's the book that I pull out when I say, oh, I'm getting off course. I need to get back on track. It's an excellent book. And then, of course, the book, Please Understand Me, that I mentioned earlier, and another one on temperaments called Self-Esteem, Gift of God. And you can come up and look at those books afterwards if you want to. Just one more thought. The psalmist said this, when I was in great need, the Lord saved me. And I really feel like that's what God has done for me during the past couple of years. I was in great need, greater need than I had ever been in, greater need than I ever thought I would be in. I was in great need, and God proved himself to be patient and loving and very accepting of my human weaknesses. He saved me from the drivenness that had been fed by my insecurities, and he helped me to accept the fragile child that I am. And for that, I can and I do truly adore him. Why don't we pray? Father, I just want to thank you for these women here today who have been so attentive and so affirming in their smiles and in their eyes. I have felt their warmth flowing back to me, and I appreciate that. I thank you for the high mission and calling that we've all been given to help build your church, and that really is a privilege. There is nothing on earth that I would rather be doing than what we're doing, and I feel that it's a great honor. And yet, Lord, it's not easy, and we make mistakes, and we get ourselves into trouble, and we need help, and sometimes we end up in great pain, And Father, I pray for the women today here who may be in pain. I pray that you will comfort them, that you will allow them to feel your love in a new way. Give them the courage to drop the barriers and admit that they are a fragile child and that they need your love very much. And I pray that in the discussion that follows and in the lunch that follows, that we may be encouragers for one another, that we may support one another in this common journey that we share. And I thank you that you are a God that meets with us personally and is willing to hear our struggles and accept our weaknesses and rebuild our lives when we need that. I thank you for your power that does that. In Jesus' name, amen.